And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news from right here in Free Radio Santa Cruz. Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy because there might be something you want to write down. It might be in a web page, might be a date or time, something happening you want to remember to get to it, something you might want to remember later. So have that pencil and paper handy. Let's start off with announcements. The Utah Tar Sands Resistance tells us they're having a fall campout in the Book Cliffs of Utah, September 19th through the 21st. And it's going to be a weekend of stories and connecting with the land. We found this announcement on the Earth First Newswire. On the week of September 19th and 21st, Utah Tar Sands Resistance and Friends will be hosting a fall campout in the Book Cliffs. It will be time for folks from the Uinta Basin, Moab, Grand Junction, and other surrounding areas to meet, visit the land, and share stories about regional struggles. There will be fireside chats featuring stories about important regional movements, such as the nuclear test site protests and past efforts to halt tar sands mining in the Colorado Plateau. We'll also have bird watching, animal tracking, plant identification walks as we get to know the land better. And we'll talk about the indigenous history of the Tavaputs Plateau. We're holding this gathering because we realize we have much to learn from other regional movements. We also realize that sharing stories with one another empowers all of us to take bolder action for a just and livable future. Please join us in strengthening the regional network of people committed to keeping this little planet of ours alive through the deep work of conversation, sharing our experiences, fears, and yes, joys, as we talk about what resistance means to us and what gives us hope for the region we love so much. We will announce the specific campsite closer to the date, but it will be in the PR Springs area. Those of us living on the plateau this summer have discovered a variety of beautiful sites to camp that we are excited to share with you all. We'll post signs prior to the event to make sure everyone can easily find it. Breakfasts and dinners will be provided. Bring your own lunches and snacks. If you want more information, email tarsandsresist@riseup.net. That's tarsandsresist@riseup.net. And their fall campout, September 19th through the 21st in the PR Springs area of the Book Cliffs, somewhere in Utah. And 20% of Africa's elephants have been killed in the last 3 years. This story by Jeremy Hance of Munga Bay from the Earth First Newswire. Around 100,000 elephants were killed by poachers for their ivory on the African continent in just 3 years, according to a new paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Between 2010 and 12, an average of 6.8% of the elephant population was killed annually, equaling just over 20% of the continent's population at the time. Elephant deaths are now exceeding births, which on average are 5% annually. We are shredding the fabric of elephant society and exterminating populations across the continent, lead author George Whitmire told the organization Save the Elephants on BBC, noting that old elephants are often the first killed. Elephants are being killed for their ivory, which is then smuggled abroad to mostly China, but also to Thailand, the Philippines, the United States, and Europe. Unfortunately, data on elephant populations across Africa is uneven and in many places scant, making continent-wide estimates like these difficult. In this case, the researchers used some of the best-studied populations in Samburu, Kenya, to determine how many elephants were dying of natural causes versus poachers on the site. They then used two different methods to extrapolate this data. At first, they employed a good data on 12 sites across Africa to estimate the total poachers butcher kill over the last few years. And the second, they used computer modeling to estimate poaching levels at 306 sites. Both methods came to similar numbers, 101,784 elephants killed versus 99,997 elephants, respectively, over the three-year period. This is the best work available from the best data we have using officials from the top organization. So, in my mind, this is the best you're going to get at the moment, Whitmire told the Associated Press. Because of the magnitude of the issue and the politics, we've been very careful. The scrutiny we did internally was at a much greater level than the questions we got in the peer review process. The numbers are also quite similar to other estimates from wildlife conservation groups. For example, the Wildlife Conservation Society has estimated that around 35,000 elephants are being killed annually on the continent. Others put the number significantly lower at between 22 and 25,000 annually. In all, conservation estimates are that around 400,000 elephants on the continent, but no one knows for sure. However, the situation is far from hopeless. There are still some countries in Africa where poaching is infrequent, and elephant populations are on the rise, such as Botswana. The numbers killed may be dropping. According to the study, slaughter peaked in 2011, with an estimated 40,000 elephants poached, or about 8% of the population. The next year, 2012, the number killed dropped to around 35,000. Intriguingly, our analysis suggests the rate of killing slowed after the peak in 2011, both locally in Samburu and globally, although it still remained unsustainable, the scientists wrote. It is critical to identify the drivers of this change in the rate of illegal killing. They note that the drop may have to do with restricting ivory auctions in China at the end of 2011. Moreover, Africa's elephants had already survived a massive poaching crisis in the 1970s and 80s. I have to be an optimist, co-author and founder of Save the Elephants, Ian Douglas Hamilton, said. I've been through all of this before in the 1970s and 80s. As a collective group, we stopped that killing, and in the savannas there was a reprieve of 20 years. I believe that we can do it again. The conservationist told the BBC that if rates don't slow, the African elephant could be extinct within a century. Complicating matters, there is recent evidence that there are actually two, not one, species of elephant on the African continent. A 2010 study found that forest elephants, smaller, sporting straighter tusks, and residing in rainforests, are as distinct from their savanna cousins as Asian elephants are from woolly mammoths. Yes, forest elephants are rushing faster to extinction than savanna elephants. Last year, a study estimated that 62% of forest elephants had been slaughtered by poachers between 2002 and 2011. Tonight, we're going to have a requiem for a species in this story by Beeline, as found on Indie Bay and the Earth First Newswire. Coming up in a couple of days, September 1st is the 100th anniversary of the death of the very last passenger pigeon, a species that people believed could never go extinct, but went from billions to zero in just a few years. On a fall day in 1813, Jean-Jacques Audubon left Henderson, Kentucky, en route to Louisville. It was on this trip that he described a flock of passenger pigeons so large and vast that the light of the noonday was obscured as if by an eclipse. Audubon estimated that in just 3 hours, 1,115,136,000 pigeons passed overhead. The entire flock took 3 days to pass over. What is more staggering is that flock of 1 billion pigeons could consume the amount of nuts, seeds, and berries that would fill a container 120 feet high with a length and width of 2 football fields each day. North America, with its huge forests and fertile prairies at the time, was a very productive place. Unfortunately, for future generations, preserving the long-term natural productivity in the U.S. meant nothing to the Anglo-centric business culture. Passenger pigeons were killed by market hunters in every way possible. The lust for a few dollars drove pigeoners to burn sulfur under roost trees, chop them down, or even use explosives to blast the trees at night. Nestlings were killed en masse on the nesting grounds and shipped to the East Coast for a few pennies per bird. It's documented that one pigeoner shipped at least 3 million birds to market. In this grim business, pig farmers even herded their pigs to the killing grounds so that the pigs could eat the pigeon entrails left by the pigeon hunters. A reporter for the Chicago Field magazine in 1889 noted that destroying the game meant the Indians became dependent upon the American government policies for food annuities. Thus, when a few conservation-minded people asked for protection for passenger pigeons, they were ignored by most of the state legislatures and the federal government. Lawmakers of the time used the excuse that such a plentiful species could never go extinct, while knowing at the same time Indians were being pressured to give in to government repression. This September 1st marks the 100th anniversary of the death of the very last passenger pigeon named Martha that died in the Cincinnati Zoological Park in 1914. The billions of passenger pigeons, along with the vast and extremely productive forests and prairies, are now gone, but the relentless procession of economic self-interest continues, crushing one species after another. There are those who are hopeful that passenger pigeon DNA could be used to clone and revive the species, But how does one clone 500,000 acres of prime hardwood forest for them to live in? I have always hoped that Americans would have learned from what was probably the largest biological crime in history. But as I watch along our north coast and as the Sacramento River and Native American cultures are getting perilously close to extinction, I'm not so sure. So here's to Martha, the last of her kind. May she not have died in vain. A description from Wikipedia. The passenger pigeon, or wild pigeon, is an extinct North American bird named after the French word passenger for passing by. It was once the most abundant bird in North America and possibly the world. It accounted for more than a quarter of all the birds in North America when it was alive. The species lived in enormous migratory flocks until early in the 20th century when hunting and habitat destruction led to its demise. One flock in 1866 in southern Ontario was described as being 1 mile wide and 300 miles long, took 14 hours to pass, and held in excess of 3.5 billion birds. That number, if accurate, would likely represent a large fraction of the entire population at the time. Some estimate that 3 to 5 billion passenger pigeons were in the United States when Europeans arrived in North America. Others argue the species had not been common in the pre-Columbian period, but their numbers grew when devastation of the American Indian population by European diseases led to reduced competition for food. And an island youth has climbed a tree in protest of development in this story by Cecilia Garza of the Bainbridge Island Review, as found in the Earth First Newswire. One Bainbridge resident who opposes the controversial shopping development to be built at High School Road and Highway 305 has taken to the trees. Bainbridge High School graduate Chiara D'Angelo is sitting 70 feet up on a platform roped to an evergreen tree in a protest that started early Monday morning. Organizers of the Tree Sid said it's one of 800 trees planned to be cut down for the shopping center. The Tree Sid, the first in the state since 1999, organizers said, followed a candlelight vigil and a demonstration against the development project Saturday night. A new shopping center is wholly unnecessary on Bainbridge Island, said Kent Bridwell, a lead organizer behind a boycott pledge that began last month. Too many local businesses have already failed and there are vacant storefronts everywhere, he said. D'Angelo's Tree Sit is designed to create more time for the community to move into action and voice their opposition to the project. Ohio-based developer Visconsi received approval to begin clear-cutting the land earlier this month. The clearing will be the first step in building a nearly 62,000-square-foot shopping center directly across from the Ace Hardware store. The development will include a Bartell Drugs, a Key Bank branch, restaurants, professional services, and healthcare facilities. In protest of the project, Angela led 80 residents of all ages Saturday on a candlelight vigil at the site. The demonstration continued in the morning as D'Angelo picketed alongside the busy intersection before making it up a more than 70-foot-tall evergreen. Two Bainbridge officers were called to the scene just after 8 a.m. Monday morning and were helping direct traffic to the pro-build. Bainbridge Island Fire Department also responded but determined D'Angelo was not in immediate danger. And in a related story, trees are spiked in solidarity with the Bainbridge Island Tree Sit in this story from Puget Sound Anarchists, as found on the Earth First Newswire. For a couple of days now, a woman has been sitting in a tree on Bainbridge Island to block the construction of a mini-mall and to protect the trees that would be clear-cut and the ecosystem that would be devastated. We noticed that despite the media spectacle and the police presence, there was really no one watching the woods. Donning black from head to toe in the bright light of day, we spiked about an eighth of the trees in the woods with ceramic rods. Now, some of you may say that tree spiking is dangerous, but only one worker has ever been hurt by a tree spike, and he admitted it was due to poor safety conditions at the mill where he worked. Metal, rocks, and the like get caught in trees all the time. The most common of these is barbed wire, which has mutilated many a worker, but something no one else seems to complain about. This is probably because people care more about property than other life forms' well-being. Well, anyway, solidarity with all those wonderful rebels out there, signed some anarchists. And once again, trees have been spiked at the Bainbridge Island proposed development. So if you are a tree worker, be very careful out there. And the Forest Service will allow logging of burned trees near Yosemite National Park. In this story by Sharon Bernstein, editing by Peter Cooney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The U.S. Forest Service said on Wednesday it would sell thousands of trees burned in last year's devastating Rim wildfire around Yosemite National Park to loggers in an effort to reduce fuel for future blazes and stimulate the regional economy. In a draft decision, the agency said it planned to allow logging on about 33,000 acres near the park, less than initially proposed, but more than environmentalists wanted. Under the plan, which is expected to be finalized next month, logging companies would remove hazardous trees in danger of falling on roads or people from about 17,000 acres in the Stanislaus National Forest and other trees salvageable for lumber from about 15,000 acres. And they managed to keep the loggers out of some roadless areas. That's at least a good thing. A bad thing is that the wolf hunt law has been approved by the Michigan House, in this story by Jonathan Osting from MLive, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Wolf hunting can continue in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, provided the Michigan Natural Resource Commission approves a second season. The Republican-led House on Wednesday approved and enacted a citizen-initiated law that will effectively undermine two anti-wolf hunt proposals set to appear on the November ballot. The new law, sent to the legislature via a statewide petition drive and approved by the Senate 2 weeks ago, reaffirms the ability of the Natural Resources Commission to name game species and establish hunting seasons. It does not require the governor's signature. It is crucial to Michigan's future that we respect and honor the fishing and hunting heritage by maintaining a factual, science-based approach, said State Representative Andrea LaFontaine, a Republican from Columbus Township who voted for the bill. Leadership did not have to take up the proposal, and critics urged them to let it head to the ballot, where it would have competed with referendums on two previous wolf hunt laws that will now mean little. The debate was heated and the vote close. The measure passed the lower chamber 65-43 as opponents and proponents who had rallied outside the Capitol area in the day looked down from the gallery above. If they are so certain that this is the correct way for Michigan to go, why do they have to lose by letting the people of the state of Michigan vote, said Representative Vicki Barnett, a Democrat from Farmington Hills, told 100 activists at the anti-wolf hunt rally. They know they're wrong, so they're using loopholes and tricks to circumvent your constitutional rights, and I won't stand for it. Michigan is currently home to an estimated 636 gray wolves, all located in the Upper Peninsula. Voters in other parts of the state shouldn't make a decision that primarily impacts residents north of the bridge, according to Michael Leonard of the Safari Club International Lansing chapter. The people in the Upper Peninsula, they're living with these animals, said Leonard, who rallied with about a dozen hunters outside the Capitol. We don't have wolves down here. We don't know. We don't have to deal with it. I don't think it's fair for the majority to decide on the minority for what's happening in the Upper Peninsula. Republican State Representative Ed McBroom of Vulcan and Democratic Representative John Cavella of Marquette, both from the Upper Peninsula, spoke in support of the measure on the House floor, citing reported wolf attacks on livestock and dogs. Our entire peninsula is being affected, and people's lives are being affected in a way that's adverse to our whole culture, McBroom said, noting lawmakers from around the state came together to approve a bankruptcy settlement for Detroit earlier this year. We need your help. Michigan's wolf population grew dramatically in the 1990s and the early 2000s, prompting removal from both state and federal species endangered lists. Supporters say hunts are needed to manage the population, arguments bolstered by recent news that wolves had killed 5 hunting dogs in the span of 3 days, along with a cow. But hunt critics say the wolf population does not justify a hunt so soon after government protections were lifted. They note that existing laws already allow farmers to kill nuisance wolves on their property, and that wolves, unlike deer, are not shot for food. This isn't about guns or hunting, Kathy Caraba of Battle Creek said before the morning rally. This is about a species of animal that needs to be protected. There is no rhyme or reason for killing these animals. 22 wolves were illegally killed in 3 regions of the Upper Peninsula last year during Michigan's first ever wolf hunt, about half the number the state had hoped for. AMLive.com investigation found government half-truths falsehoods and livestock numbers skewed by a single farmer distorted some arguments for the inaugural hunt. And Washington State okays a hunt for wolves killing sheep in this story from the Houston Chronicle, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Washington State officials approved the killing of a portion of a wolf pack in northeastern Washington, sending hunters aboard a helicopter during the weekend to take aim at the wolves. Officials from the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife approved the killings for the Huckleberry Pack in Stevens County after 22 sheep were killed this month. But a conservation group argues that the state did not exhaust non-lethal methods before ordering the hunt. The hunt's announcement comes after the state authorized a rancher to shoot the same wolves approaching his flock of 1,800 sheep. The state Fish and Wildlife Department said efforts to deter the pack have failed, the spokesman review reported. In an effort to break the predation cycle, agency director Phil Anderson said he authorized on Saturday the killing of four wolves from the pack, which is estimated at up to 12 members. Officials will later evaluate whether that is enough lethal force to end the sheep attacks. Gunners in a helicopter began flying over the area near hunters on Saturday. A wolf was spotted, but officials said no wolves were killed. A male wolf is wearing a radio collar that researchers attached to monitor the pack. As of Friday, we had confirmed that 17 sheep had been killed by wolves in five separate incidents, and we continue to find more dead and wounded sheep from the flock, said Bruce Botka, agency spokesman. Botka said the situation meets the state's conditions for lethal removal of wolves, which are protected in eastern Washington by state endangered species law. The pack is one of about a dozen wolf packs confirmed in eastern Washington. There have been repeated documented wolf kills. Non-lethal methods have not stopped the predation. The attacks are likely to continue, and the livestock owner has done nothing to attract the wolves, he said. The Huckleberry Pack, named from the nearby Huckleberry Mountains, was documented as a pack in 2012. The pack had not been associated with attacks on livestock until this month, officials said. It's unconscionable that a public agency would take action to kill an endangered species without notifying the public. These wolves belong to the public, and decisions about whether they live or die ought to be made in the clear light of day, said Amarok Weiss, West Coast Wolf Organizer for the Center for Biological Diversity. Weiss's group argues the state did not exhaust non-lethal methods, including failing to move the sheep to another parcel of land, not having human presence by the herd, and not removing dead sheep carcasses. The pack also has pups, Weiss's group said, noting that if adults were killed, the young wolves may die from lack of food. The events are reminiscent of 2012 wolf attacks on cattle in northern Stevens County that didn't end until the state was forced to use helicopter gunners to kill all seven members of the Wedge Pack. And continuing with news from Washington, the world's largest dam removal has unleashed the Elwha River. In this story by Michelle Nehus, National Geographic has found on the Earth First Newswire. Recently, on a remote stretch of the Elwha River in northwestern Washington state, a demolition crew hired by the National Park Service detonated a battery of explosives within the remaining section of the Glines Canyon Dam. If all went well, the blast destroyed the last 30 feet of the 210-foot-high dam and signals the culmination of the largest dam removal project in the world. While in Asia, Africa, and South America, large hydroelectric dams are still being built, as they once were in the United States, to power economic development, with the added argument now that the electricity they provided is free of greenhouse gas emissions. But while the United States still benefits from the large dams it built in the 20th century, there is a growing recognition that in some cases, at least, dam building went too far, and the Elwha River is a symbol of that. The removal of the Glines Canyon Dam and the Elwha Dam, a smaller downstream structure, began in late 2011. 3 years later, salmon are migrating past the former dam sites, trees and shrubs are sprouting in the drained reservoir beds, and sediment once trapped behind the dams is rebuilding beaches at the Elwha's outlet to the sea. For many, the recovery is the realization of what once seemed a far-fetched fantasy. 30 years ago, when I was in law school in the Pacific Northwest, removing the dams from the Elwha River was seen as a crazy wild idea, said Bob Irwin, president and CEO of the conservation group American Rivers. Now dam removal is an accepted way to restore a river. It's become a mainstream idea. The Elwha River runs for 45 miles from the Olympic Mountains to the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but all its final 5 miles lies within what is now Olympic National Park. Long before the park was established in 1938, the river was regionally famous as the richest salmon river on the Olympic Peninsula. For generations, the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe, whose members live at the mouth of the Elwha, depended on the river's fish and shellfish for survival. But the peninsula was also famous for its massive trees, and in the early 1900s, the local timber industry needed power for its mills and its growing ranks of workers. Fish were no match for finance, and the 108-foot-high Elwha Dam, located 5 miles upstream from the river's outlet, started generating power in 1914. There's no question but that the Elwha was harnessed at last and forever, a local newspaper reported crowed at the time. The larger Glynde's Canyon Dam, 8 miles further upstream and inside what is now Olympic National Park, began operations in 1927. For almost half a century, the two dams were widely applauded for powering the growth of the peninsula and its primary industries. But the dams blocked salmon migration up the Elwha, devastating its fish and shellfish and the livelihood of the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe. As the tribe slowly gained political power and it won federal recognition in 1968, it and other tribes began to protest the loss of fishing rights promised to them by a federal treaty in the mid-1800s. In 1979, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Washington tribes, including the Elwha Klallam, were entitled to half the salmon catch in the state. With this court victory behind them, the tribes began to fight for the protection and restoration of salmon runs. In the mid-1980s, the Elwha Klallam and their environmental groups started to push for dam removal in earnest, arguing that their environmental costs and safety risks outweighed their benefits, especially because the Olympic Peninsula had long since been connected to the regional power grid, and the dams now provided only a small fraction of the power used by the residents and mills. In 1992, Congress authorized federal purchase of the two dams on the Elwha from the timber companies that owned them and ordered a study of the idea of removing them, and now they are gone. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. here on FRSC 101.3 and freakradio.org. If you live in the Moscow, Idaho area, tune in to KRFP. Radio Free Moscow, 90.3 FM at 9:30 on Monday nights, for a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update. Or you could go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen to a podcast or download the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio News and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.